This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.
Welcome to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of Tonic Magazine, Jamie Busson.
Hi, I'm Jamie Busson. I'm a former commercial litigator who used to weigh 242 pounds. When I was 38 years old, I lost over 50 pounds through a regimen of exercise and better nutrition. It took me a year to reach my goal, but I thought if a type A personality like me could do it, really anybody can. I'm still asking questions and learning about what it means to live a healthy lifestyle. Please join me on this continuing journey. Today, we'll discuss how to prepare yourself for allergy season with clinical pharmacist Andy Donald. We'll find out about the food as medicine trend with author and public health advocate Dr. Charles Plackin, PhD. We'll learn about the interplay between detoxification and stress on your body with naturopath Dr. Penny Kendall-Reed. And lastly, we'll discover whether psilocybin is a working woman's life hack with retreat leaders Gary Logan and Rob Grover. Before we get to that, here's your tonic quick shot. In a recent study, 151 human participants were pitted against ChatGPT-4 in three tests designed to measure divergent thinking, which is considered to be an indicator of creative thought. Divergent thinking is characterized by the ability to generate a unique solution to a question that does not have one expected solution, such as, what's the best way to avoid talking about politics with my parents? In the study, GPT-4 provided more original and elaborate answers than the human participants. The three tests utilized were the alternative use task, which asks participants to come up with creative uses for everyday objects like a rope or a fork, the consequences task, which invites participants to imagine possible outcomes of hypothetical situations, like what if humans no longer needed sleep, and the divergent associations task, which asks participants to generate 10 nouns that are as semantically distant as possible. Ultimately, the authors found that overall, GPT-4 was more original and elaborate than humans on each of the divergent thinking tasks, even when controlling for fluency of responses. In other words, GPT-4 demonstrated higher creative potential across an entire battery of divergent thinking tasks. Now, this finding does come with some caveats. The authors state, it's important to note that the measures used in this study are all measures of creative potential, but not the involvement in creative activities or achievements or other aspects of measuring a person's creativity. AI, unlike humans, does not have agency and is dependent on the assistance of a human user. Therefore, the creative potential of AI is in a constant state of stagnation unless prompted. Also, the researchers did not evaluate the appropriateness of GPT-4 responses. Whether the tests are a perfect measure of human creative potential is not really the point. The point is that large language models are rapidly progressing and outperforming humans in ways they have not before. Whether they are a threat to replace human creativity remains to be seen. Question: what's the best way to make sure you're getting the most up-to-date and accurate health and wellness information? Answer: the Tonic newsletter, of course. Visit www.thetonic.ca and sign up today. I'll be joined by Andy Donald in a moment, but first, a little bit of business. Tired of lineups at your pharmacist? Why not try PharmaZ at the Zoomer Store? Powered by the Health Depot, an Ontario-accredited pharmacy, PharmaZ offers a concierge approach to filling, refilling, and managing your prescriptions with free delivery anywhere in Ontario. To get started, visit zoomerstore.com and click on PharmaZ, and then click on the Circle of Care Pharmacy program for your free initial consultation with a clinical pharmacist. Don't wait. Go today. Andy Donald is a certified geriatric pharmacist and president of the Health Depot Pharmacy. His passion to help patients and deliver personalized services led him to launch the Health Depot, Canada's only online clinical pharmacy. Andy's active in his profession, serving on several committees, including the Alzheimer's Society of Ontario's Ontario Dementia Care Alliance, and he's the Prescribe It Pharmacy Ambassador for Canada Health InfoWay. The Health Depot Pharmacy is an online clinical pharmacy providing free, no-obligation consultations. They'll meet with you to discuss your medications and answer your questions and deliver your prescriptions free anywhere in Ontario. For more information, you can visit thehealthdepot.ca. Welcome back to the show, Andy. How you doing, man?
Not too bad. Good to be back, Jamie.
So, just in the nick of time, because with El Nino and not quite as cold a winter as we are used to, I'm feeling like allergy season has started a bit early. Do you feel that way?
Absolutely. Like I even saw just this past weekend, it's early, barely March, and there's already mosquitoes out. It's coming earlier every year, that's for sure.
Global warming, woo! All right.
Woo.
So,
yeah.
So what are the most common triggers of seasonal allergies?
Well, it's this season. We're going into two big ones coming up. The spring, when everything starts to bud, pollen on trees, grasses, weeds are very common in the spring, flowering, right? Mm-hmm. And then mold, dust mites. After the first thaw, mold is very, very common. Old leaves and things from last year getting into the air, causing allergies. And then as the season progresses, is more into the weeds and ragweed, which is one of the worst ones. It's one that's been devastating me for years.
Yeah, me too.
That starts the end of July and goes all the way until November.
Yeah, I have there's two seasons for me. There's cold and allergy. So
yeah,
we don't have four seasons here for me. So, so what are the types of things that can worsen allergy symptoms, though?
Well, I mean, stress is a big one. That's one that people are not really aware of, that, you know, even though allergies, what they are, is your body overreacting with an immune response and you know, trying to fight something that enters his body excessively is the issue with allergies, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, chronic stress can cause your body to release cortisol, which actually weakens your immune system. You'd think that would help you with, you know, having less of a reaction to whatever allergens in your body. But at the same time, your body with chronic stress releases histamine, which, as we know, antihistamines are what helps us treat allergy reactions, because histamines, yeah, once you, with chronic stress, enter your whole bloodstream and causes our body to overswell and overreact to certain allergens.
Would you consider that, like, you know, air quality aside from allergens is also an exacerbating factor? Like, you know, for example, the fires that kind of raged across the country last year, putting smoke into the air, or pollution? Are those elements?
Absolutely.
Too?
Well, it's just like even smoking cigarettes, right?
Yeah.
So anything that enters our lungs that we're breathing that is not supposed to be there can cause our lungs to swell up and overreact, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the more they swell up and overreact, the more likelihood that, they're either hypersensitive already. So when an allergen that you already technically overreact to comes into your lungs again, or your nose or wherever, your body will even have that much more of an exaggerated reaction to the allergen. So it's because the immune cells are already there and the histamine's already been released. So then it just feeds it forward even more. Absolutely. Air quality is a big issue for allergies.
Okay. So with these allergens that are just floating in the air, can we reasonably try and avoid allergens? Is that possible?
Avoidance definitely helps to the point where, you know, you have less contact with the allergen, you're less likely to react. So for instance, cat and dog allergies, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's best if you have really bad cat and allergy dogs, like so that I have as well, right? Just breathing it in, the dander is enough to set my lungs off.
Mm-hmm.
It's best that you don't have a cat or dog, or avoid houses that have them. However, environmental allergies that are seasonal ones are particularly tricky because they float around in the millions and billions outside anytime you go outside the entire season, right?
Mm-hmm.
So to avoid environmental allergies, it helps to stay indoors during peak pollen times,
right,
which are different for different allergies. So grass pollen, for instance, is usually highest in the afternoon and evening. So if you have bad allergies to that, then it's best to stay away from outside in the spring as much as you can.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas ragweed is more of an early morning to midday. So you can minimize that as well. And then it's very important if you have bad seasonal allergies to leave your windows closed. Right, have good purifiers, air conditioners, and with HEPA filters, purifiers, to regular clean your home, and at least have your house air void of as much allergens as possible.
Right, and you know, it's not a new phenomenon, but there are certain sort of apps that will tell you if there's more pollen in the air. Right, have you seen those?
Yeah, I've heard of those. I haven't used them myself, but yeah, like there's a lot of apps that can tell you seasonal or air quality,
right,
that can be very helpful. Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, hopefully they are more
effective than some of the, like the weather apps, which, you know, if it tells you it's a 50% chance it's going to rain, I don't even know what you do with that information.
It's like they're just guessing at a Ouija board, right? Sometimes they really don't know.
Exactly. Yeah. Okay, so if avoidance may or may not assist you, I think we have to turn to medications, right?
Often, yes. So, I mean, avoidance can help reduce the severity, but it can't really eliminate the allergens. We can't hide in our homes the whole entire season, right? So antihistamines are very important. So the typical ones, the best ones to go for that really help to lower histamine release in your blood, because that's where allergies come from, is the second generation antihistamines, which ones we recognize as Arius, Claritin, and Reactine are the brand names, right?
Yep.
They're the ones of choice because they can be taken every 12 to 24 hours, which lasts a long time. In low doses, the over-the-counter doses, they're not very sedating, which is good, right? But it's very important to stick with those ones. You can take in two of those pills of the extra strength over the counter is the prescription strength. So, and often, like, it's much cheaper, believe it or not, that's a good hack, than getting a prescription antihistamine because most drug plans don't cover those. So just taking two extra strength Claritins, if you have really bad, or Arius is even better, desloratadine, is the same as taking a prescription strength one. But Benadryl is something, it's reserved, should be not taken regularly for sleep particularly, or for, you know, just seasonal allergies, because it lasts very short term. But they're, like we talked about this in the past, it's one of the most anticholinergic drugs out there that causes like dry mouth, dry eyes, urinary incontinence, constipation, but actually can lead towards dementia if you take it long term. So it should be reserved for strictly severe allergic reactions where you're swelling up a lot and you might have difficulty breathing, obviously, where you need to seek medical attention.
So nasal sprays, and I want to understand what you mean when we talk about nasal sprays. What are we talking about?
So usually people talk about decongestants, right, for nasal sprays that are over-the-counter. There is also nasal steroids. So a couple important things you need to know. So actually, going back to the antihistamine pills.
Yeah.
It's best to avoid the ones that say sinus on them. Okay, and I'll explain why, because this will lead into the nasal spray. They have Sudafed or any they have a oral decongestant in them.
Yep.
And that's not meant. Oral decongestants can be useful if for treating a cold, if you're having a cold for like 5 to 7 days tops. But you have to be careful. If you have heart issues or high blood pressure, you shouldn't be taking it. But what it does is it actually can cause something called rebound congestion.
Yep.
And the problem is why they're terrible, and we should never, ever take an allergy medication, especially seasonal allergies, with a decongestant in it. People are going to be taking that for 3-4 months,
yep,
right? And after a week of a decongestant, it's actually causing you to be congested.
Well, I was addicted to Otrivin when I was a kid. I had terrible allergies.
Yeah.
And so the thing about Otrivin is it's amazing. I don't know what it does to your flesh and inside your nose, but it allows those passages to open. But as soon as it wears off, it would tighten back even worse. And then, of course, you need more and more and more and more and more. And I became completely addicted to it, such that, like, if I didn't have the Otrivin, I couldn't breathe at all. And so I had to stop taking
trick.
Yeah.
I'm like, even one of my, I have a pharmacist friend who was addicted to that for a bit as well, who knows the science. So the idea behind it versus oral versus nasal, it's even worse. So what it's doing is decongestants, they go inside and they constrict your blood vessels, right?
Yeah.
So they constrict it to make it so it ups, that's how it ups your blood pressure too. That's why you can't take it if you have high blood pressure. But nasally, like, it constricts them to then less fluid can get to the nose and doesn't clog you up. Well, your body doesn't like that. And over time, that's why in simply 3 to 5 days of nasal decongestants, your body after a period of time says, no, I need to have it opened up because these allergens. So they release your own factors to open up your arteries even more. So they start fighting the decongestant.
Yeah. Yeah.
So then you get that rebound congestion because your body says, no, I need them open, not closed. And then you have to keep using more decongestant to try to fight it. So that's why maximum 3 to 5 days for the nasal decongestants. But when it comes to allergies, and this is a big point, even growing up in a doctor family, right?
Yeah.
I had terrible ragweed that I was constantly a faucet dripping out of my nose.
Yeah.
The oral antihistamines don't touch your actual nasal congestion much at all. So instead of 5 stars, they get a star rating of about a 0.5 star out of 5 for antihistamines, the oral pills.
Yeah.
They help with the eyes, they help with the skin, they don't really touch your nose. Whereas nasal steroids are 5 out of 5. So they're the ones, if you need to take something long-term for your nose, nasal steroids are it. And they build up over time. So you have to take it for about a week to 10 days for it to really kick in. I find it helps after 2 to 3 days. But dear God, I have to take it the entire ragweed season, all the way from last week of July until the first solid frost in November.
Yep.
And then I go on a holiday, because the risk is you don't want to be taking nasal steroids forever, because over time it can thin the membrane in your nose.
I was just going to say.
Steroids can do, and you can get a nosebleed.
You touched upon it a moment ago. What do we do if we have itchy, scratchy, dry eyes, et cetera, because of allergies?
There's multiple eye drops that can treat, but believe it or not, yeah, I kind of mentioned it, the oral antihistamines work phenomenal for the eyes. They help the eyes a lot. So you can take those if you know you're going to be in an area with an allergen, and that should help you a lot with your eyes. And if you need a little bit extra help, there are antihistamine eye drops that have like various different antihistamines in them. That's more for treatment if your eyes are really itchy and red.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas there's something called chromalin eye drops that are more preventative. You can take them to prevent you getting an allergic reaction ahead of time.
Sometimes for me, just having the, the tears, like the sustain or something along those lines, can sort of get me through if I'm dry. So somebody else mentioned to me something about taking omega-3s to help with eye moisture. Have you heard anything about that?
Well, it kind of depends what's causing your eye moisture problem, right?
Okay.
So, you're right. Like those natural tears, they'll have lipids in them that help coat your eye.
Right.
So then they don't get as dry as much, right? So omega-3s, if you're not making enough, a lot of times that's a healthy natural oil that your body can actually use to make some of that surfactant oily in your tears, right? So it depends if your body's not making enough of it. That could definitely help. But those, to your point, Sustain Ultra has that in it. So when you put it on your eyes, it creates a nice little oily film that helps to maintain the moisture on your eye.
Okay, so I used to take allergy shots when I was a child and into adolescence, and I had eczema and all sorts of collateral allergy-type ailments, but I kind of grew out of it. Am I unique, or does that actually happen?
It actually does work, and I'm doing it myself now to help with my ragweed allergies. So it's kind of interesting, but what it is, it's like, you need to do it over the span of, it takes 3 to 5 years, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You have to be religious with it. You start at an infinitesimally small dose of the allergen that you have, like 1 in 10,000, let's say, from even what you would do in an allergy shot for a test. And then slowly increase that with weekly shots over 6 months. And the idea is you're trying to get your body to notice that compound, that allergen in your body at a low dose and not react to it. So you don't want to have an allergic response to it. And then you slowly increase it, and you're increasing the tolerance of your body to that compound, that it's like, hey, it's not freaking out as much, because like, hey, this is normal, right? I see this all the time, kind of thing. But you have to do it so slow. And they've actually seen where kids that are deathly allergic to peanuts have been able to do this too at such small fractions. But the thing is, in order to keep it up, like if you have an allergen like that, you have to then take whatever your dose of peanut is every single day the rest of your life to try to kind of maintain that for something as bad as a peanut allergy. But for like ragweed and whatnot, eventually, ideally, I might be able to only get a monthly injection over after, you know, a year or so, you know, half a year to a year. But it definitely works. It helps our body to desensitize our crazy immune response to that allergen. But it has to be done very controlled. It's good to speak to your doctor and an allergen if you've had an allergist specialist, right?
Yep.
Allergy specialist, if you have an issue that isn't helped by normal medications such as steroids and antihistamines.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for coming on the show today.
It was a pleasure. Thanks as always, Jamie.
That was Andy Donald. We have to take a short break, but when we return, we'll discuss the food as medicine trend on The Tonic. Attention men over 50. Do you search for restrooms everywhere you go? Wake up several times at night just to go pee again? Are symptoms of a benign enlarged prostate taking over? Prostate Perform helps reduce the urgency and frequency of pesky pit stops in as little as 7 to 10 days. Available exclusively through natural health food stores. To ensure these products are right for you, always follow label directions. I'd like to give a shout out to our long-standing sponsor, Omega Alpha. This company is 100% Canadian-owned. Their team consists of allopathic and naturopathic doctors, nutritionists, researchers, and other scientific professionals, all led by their CEO, Dr. Gordon Chang. Formulations are created on their 40,000-square-foot facility located in Toronto. Omega Alpha uses only the highest quality ingredients to manufacture the most efficacious yet price-friendly nutraceuticals. For more information about Omega Alpha,
Visit OmegaAlpha.com.
Welcome back to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of Tonic Magazine, Jamie Bussin.
Charles Plotkin, Ph.D., J.D., M.P.H., is a distinguished lecturer at Hunter College in New York City and the former executive director of the Hunter College New York City Food Policy Center. He's also the founder and director of the Center for Food as Medicine, known as foodmedcenter.org. Additionally, Dr. Plotkin is a nutrition and public health advocate whose syndicated health, nutrition, and fitness column, The Diet Detective, appears in more than 100 daily newspaper and media outlets. He's also the founder of dietdetective.com, which offers more than 700 articles and interviews on nutrition, food, and fitness. Welcome back to the show, Charles. How are you?
Thanks, Jamie. Thanks for having me back on.
So, food as medicine, that's sort of a concept that I think a lot of us have probably read or heard about, but may not know exactly what it means. What does that mean to you?
Yeah, oh my goodness. Yeah, of course. I mean, this is a term that's being bantered around all over the internet. Even the White House is having food as medicine conferences, and people are just still looking at this going, food is medicine. What are they talking about? Does that mean we don't take our diabetes medicine and we should just eat food? And it's just so complicated and so such a name that's being used to get grants and sell product and do all the things it's not supposed to do. I mean, food as medicine is not new. It's thousands of years old, and it was something that was used in ancient Greece. It was used, certainly in Asia and many other countries, and it was because there was no there were no expert pharmaceutical products that actually were geared toward disease, right? That you could just take something and penicillin and it solves the problem. However, we've reached a point in the concept that is unique, right? There's been a resurgence. Are we looking at it? And I will give you one example. Think of scurvy. Do you know what scurvy is, with a lack of vitamin C?
The sailors, the British used to come across, and they called them limeys because they suck on limes to get their vitamin C.
Yeah, exactly. So that had to be, I'm no historian, but in the 1600s, is my guess, and I don't have that information right at my fingertips, so I'm being honest with the audience. I don't know the exact date, but from memory that serves me, it's around that time. And quite frankly, that's food as medicine.
Right.
Right there.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, right? We're using vitamin C, fruit to solve a problem with disease. There's beriberi, right? Another one that's right out there in the open that, solves the disease, right? Food solves the disease. So there is a real history of food acting as medicine and even better than what a pharmaceutical product could do. Now, when I talk about food as medicine, I'm not talking about, eliminating, this is not pie in the sky kind of stuff where we're looking at things and saying, oh, well, we don't want to take medicine, because medicine is poison. Well, no, not really. Medicine saves millions and millions and millions of lives a year, right?
Yep.
But if there's combinations of food and pharma and dietary supplements that will work better, or someone has terrible reactions to the side effects of a medication, well, maybe, just maybe, there are dietary supplements or there are there's food that you could eat in your dietary changes that you can make that with the pharma could eliminate the side effects and also create much more positive results to the treatment of that disease. Does that make sense?
It does. It does. I mean, I have some ideas on why that concept probably resonates more today, which goes back to our last conversation where we were talking about information and misinformation on the internet. And I think I agree with you. I think people can carry it too far or sort of pervert it into this notion, all pharma is bad and all drugs are bad. And I'm glad to hear that's not what you think. Because I'm not there either. I'm scientifically based. I don't believe in airy-fairy or opinion-based medicine. I like facts.
I like facts too. We're coming out with a new book. It's called Eat to Cheat Death, and it'll probably be out in a year. And I just wrote the proposal. And again, I'm not plugging the book because it's not even available for selling. But, the whole idea of the book is to take an academic lens okay, holistic academic lens,
yeah,
and be agnostic, completely agnostic, not trying to sell somebody, you know, fish oil when they don't need fish oil,
right?
Or you know, but just really looking at what the evidence is saying, a plethora of the evidence.
It's interesting because I think, you know, if you took the average North American, probably not eating very well, probably not getting enough exercise or enough sleep or, you know, practicing enough mindfulness. And so, you know, changing their diet to something healthier would probably do them a world of good. It's not going to cure all their ails. But you know...
Sorry, I'm laughing, Diggy.
Yeah, don't you think?
I'm not laughing at you. I'm laughing with you. Yeah, because this is what happens, right? That's my next thing I was talking about. So the White House and, you know, politicians have embraced these medically tailored meals and prescription produce programs. Now, I think they're fantastic, but yeah. Like, they're looking at them, first of all, there's, and they'll say, oh, cancer patients need this, okay? Diabetes needs this, HIV needs this, but they're not, it took me 7 months, okay? And I'm a sophisticated researcher to draft the first chapter, you know, because when you, I don't know if people out there know, but when you create a book proposal, you first have to make, you create a book proposal before you sell a book in nonfiction space, right?
Yeah.
So in a book proposal, you usually give sample chapters and then one chapter fleshed out.
Yep.
So I did anxiety on Eat to Cheat Death. I did the anxiety chapter for, I know you're not supposed to tell everybody all this stuff, but why not?
Sure.
You heard it first on Jamie's show.
Yeah, there you go.
So, and then what you do is, you know, that proposal is about 100 pages, and the one chapter is anxiety in there that the editors can look to see if you can actually write and if you know what you're talking about.
Yep.
Well, I'm getting to a point here. The chapter on food and dietary supplements to impact anxiety took me, with four researchers, 6 months.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
To come up with some conclusions that I feel with who I am and that I'm not trying to sell anything is reputable enough, okay, to give a complete picture of what these items, these dietary supplements, and what food would do to actually impact, if at all, anxiety. So when I hear people touting medication, you know, this for that, or this magnesium will reduce this, or you know, all on TikTok and social media, or I hear medically tailored meals to help people with this disease, I want to know, what is the evidence? Who's your chief scientific officer? None of them have one,
yeah.
Okay? They right. have a chef. And believe me, I think medically tailored meals are great, and prescription produce programs are fantastic. Why? Because of exactly what you said that preceded my thought, which is that if you give people that are eating horrible garbage food, in terrible communities, okay. When I say terrible, I mean communities that have
like
high poverty rates,
food deserts, and impoverished areas.
Yeah, we don't call them food deserts anymore. We call them apartheid. There's a whole political charged concept around that.
Mm, okay.
But for lack of not using the right nomenclature between the two of us, so we don't get any letters. Basically, these areas have crappy food. That's the bottom line.
Yeah.
And the supermarkets are not available anywhere, and they have to buy food that's high priced and the worst, health-wise. Right? That's the bottom line.
Yeah.
And they suck. Okay?
Yeah.
So the reality is, yeah.
Okay, so the flip side of that is, you know, if one were inclined to try and eat a certain diet to promote better health, that can be expensive too, right? It isn't just for everybody. It's comprehensive.
I think that's a myth. I think that's a myth.
You
think
so?
Eating a healthy diet is, yeah, I do. I think it's a myth. There's a guy, Popkin is the last name. He did, not related to me, he did research and showed, and, you know, and there are many researchers that do this, because at the end of the day, you know, healthier food provides more, gets you full faster, has more nutrients, it's a little more cost effective, you know, in terms of disease and health and everything else. So there's so many things that to weigh in that assist with that, that I would, you know, that you could easily argue differently. And also, like, you know, they're putting Trader Joe's in poor communities, and Trader Joe's, you know, you can buy fruit and vegetables, you know, for a third of the price in some instances, right? So it really just depends. And I think that, and in a lot of these communities, there are mobile markets that are giving away the fruits and vegetables.
Right.
So I think it's just there's nothing coordinated, Jamie. That's the problem. It's just all ad hoc. It's all one, you know, feel good, you know, narcissistic nonprofit is trying to do something to get attention. And that, you know, it's like a shot in the arm then, but it's not consistent. There's no real thought that goes on to how do we solve food insecurity in these communities, right?
I think it's kind of complicated, too, because it isn't just the cost. It's also the time element, right? Like, I don't know about you, but, like, I spend a fair bit of time each day making my food because it matters to me, right? And the crappy food, most of what we're talking about is the stuff that you pop into the microwave and it's already been made for you, right? And so when you're looking at the food costs, it isn't just...
Or potato chips.
Right, exactly.
Things that are ultra-processed foods.
Right.
Tremendous. That's another buzzword, by the way, Jamie. Ultra-processed. We could do a whole talk on ultra-processed foods.
We've covered it before, but maybe we'll have you back and get your perspective on it. What do you think?
Yeah, and we could talk about that because it's a whole other animal, a whole other buzzword, and a whole other kind of research concept that's come up and that, you know, you could talk to for an hour about.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you so much, Jamie, and thanks for having me, and look forward to speaking to you again sometime.
That was Charles Plackin. We have to take a short break, but when we return, we'll discuss the interplay of detoxification and stress on The Tonic.
At Pure Encapsulations, good starts with uncompromising standards. This is why we avoid additives such as magnesium stearate. Although we know it could speed up production time, we also know it doesn't add any health benefits. Instead, time is our additive. To maintain the integrity of the premium ingredients that do benefit your health. But our commitment to wellness doesn't end there. It extends to our planet as well. Through our sustainability initiatives, we are making strides toward a healthier future.
Welcome back to The Tonic. Your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of Tonic Magazine, Jamie Bussin.
Dr. Penny Kendall Reed, ND, is an award-winning naturopathic doctor based in Toronto. With a background in neurobiology from McGill University and a degree in naturopathic medicine, she's become a renowned expert in personalized health programs and is the creator of the integrated genetic platform Generex.ca. Dr. Kendall Reed is also a best-selling author and serves as medical consultant for leading supplement brands such as Pure Encapsulations and Douglas Laboratories. Welcome back to the show, Penny. How are you?
I'm doing very well. Thank you so much for having me on this lovely day.
Yeah, so lovely weather. Spring may have sprung. And of course, for many in natural health, it's spring cleaning time, figuratively.
You're exactly right. We all start to think about spring cleaning our houses, but we need to start thinking about spring cleaning our bodies.
Right, which is otherwise known as a detoxification. Can you explain what that is for people who don't know?
Yeah, absolutely. So many people think that detoxification is just about not intaking toxins. So they start eating healthy, they're pulling out all of those greens. And that's not truly detoxification. That just means you're not adding to the toxic load in the body. Detoxification is where mostly our liver makes a bunch of enzymes that can identify a toxin that is stored inside of a cell. That toxin could be a heavy metal like a lead or a mercury. It could be a byproduct from an infection from a bacteria. It could be an excess hormone that's in the body that we need to clear out. So our liver will make these enzymes that can sort of flag and see that toxin. Then they change the shape of the toxin so that they can pull the toxin out easily from outside of the cell to inside of the cell. That's called phase 1 detoxification. Then phase 2 detoxification is where a different set of enzymes can come in. They see that chain-shaped toxin, they bind to it, and clear it out. So it really is a biochemical process in the body. It's not just about sort of rinsing out your colon, with a cleanse or a laxative or not intaking toxins. It really is about pulling them out of the body.
Okay. So some of these toxins that you're referring to are environmental. And, you know, I live in the T-Dot. I think you do, too.
I do.
I should never call it that. We both live in Toronto.
We do.
And we're all kind of exposed to the same levels, unless you're living in certain parts of the city where there's a lot more industrial work being done. But why is it that people react differently to all these environmental toxins that are
Absolutely.
Around us?
Absolutely. You know, there's so many wonderful parts about the city, but you're absolutely right. There is a much higher rate of toxin load in the city just from the number of people, the number of buildings, the industrialization, etc. And Toronto is rapidly catching up with the large cities around the world in terms of toxic levels. But how we react to toxins is very individual. So it's monitored or regulated by that phase one and phase two. Some people have a very slow phase two detoxification pathway, so they can't actually see that toxin in the body and pull it out of the body. Some people may have a very fast phase one detoxification. So when they go inside of the cell and change the shape of the toxin, it's actually too fast, and then they'll start to pull with it some good or benign products too. So now we start increasing an inflammatory load both inside and outside of the cell because of different rates of toxicity. And, you know, I can remember way back into cadaver lab, we could literally walk through cadaver lab and you could say, look at the color of the lungs and go city dweller, country dweller, smoker, just by the amount of toxin that gets stored inside of tissue if people can't release it from their bodies. And that rate at which we release it is all very individual.
Is it genetic?
It is exactly genetic. So it is our genes that determine the rate of both phase one and phase two detoxification. And our genes are like light switches, right? They're either in their on or their off position. And if your detoxification genes are in the off position and they're blocked from other different pathways, or genetically you have very slow detox pathways, you're going to be one of those people that gets much greater symptoms, such as headaches in exposure to them, nausea, fatigue, difficulty breathing, all of those sort of symptoms. Even acne, you know, can be a sign of a poor detoxification pathway.
Okay. So you just mentioned some indicia of difficulties. How do we know how efficient our pathways are, or therefore, like, that we need to address it?
For sure. So certainly some of those symptoms that we looked at, you know, every time you go into a city or a more polluted environment, how does your body feel? Are you more tired when you leave it? Did you have a headache? Do you get nauseous? Do you get even GI bloating or swelling? But we can also look at our blood work. We can look at our liver enzymes in our blood work, and they will pop up pretty quickly if your detoxification is slow, because your liver has to start working overtime to try to get rid of these excess toxins that are in the body, simply because our normal pathways can't eliminate it on their own. The other thing that we can take a look at in our blood work is inflammatory markers, because when these toxins are left in the body, then they start to generate a great deal of inflammation. And we can see that in a patient or in ourselves, whether it's a joint inflammation or irritation or, again, a headache. But we can also see that in our blood work, things like ESR or CRP, different inflammatory markers that will start to rise.
How does stress interplay with all of this?
Yeah, stress interplays with everything in the body, unfortunately. But stress has an impact on detoxification in a couple of different ways. First of all, the actual main stress hormone, cortisol, it in of itself is a toxin, so it actually needs to be cleared out of the body. So again, if we have poor or slow detoxification pathways, we can't get it out of the body with great ease. Cortisol also increases the production of our inflammatory markers in the body, or our inflammatory substrates, by up to 76%. And those inflammatory substrates, not only do they also act as a toxin, and they also need to be cleared out through the same pathways, but they will also sort of almost gum up or slow down the detoxification pathways themselves. And then finally, cortisol, our main stress hormone, and those inflammatory substrates, they actually will alter the expression, meaning the turning on or turning off, of over 90% of genes. So if somebody does have a really good detoxification pathway genetically, but they have a lot of cortisol or stress in their body or a lot of inflammation, that will actually turn off their great detoxification genes. Similarly, cortisol and inflammation will turn on a negative gene. So if they have poor detox pathways genetically, cortisol and inflammation will turn that on and actually augment the slowing down of the detoxification pathways once again.
All right, so you've explained the relationship going one way, but does it work the other way? In other words, does detoxification impact stress?
It does. So there is a cyclic effect between the two of them. Because when we have poor or slow detoxification pathways, all of those toxins, both inside the cell, if we can't get them out from a slow phase 1 detoxification, or outside of the cell, because we have a slow phase 2 detoxification, massively increase the production of those inflammatory markers again. And inflammation will easily cross the blood-brain barrier. And that's sort of like a wall at the base of the head, which is a protective mechanism to stop things like inflammation or toxins or bacteria from crossing through into the brain. But inflammation will sort of break down that wall, that barrier, and quickly pass through into the brain. When inflammation is in our neural tissue, it directly stimulates our stress pathways. And then those stress pathways, again, have that adverse effect on our detoxification genes and pathways, slowing them down even further, which then makes more inflammation, which then crosses the blood-brain barrier and triggers our stress pathways again. So there's a cyclic effect between stress, detoxification, and inflammation, all augmenting one another.
So we've just spent the last approximately 10 minutes scaring the hell out of everybody with talk about stress and detoxification. Please, Penny, is there anything we can do to sort of break that cycle?
There is. The first thing I would always say is, don't think that just because you have read a detoxification diet or there's a cookie cutter detoxification kit out there that it's meant for you. But going back to sort of the difference in genetics, we all require something slightly different. But some really keynote things that we can all do and are safe independent if you know your genetics. Again, eat clean. Don't bring those extra toxins into you, particularly in terms of the dark green leafies and vegetables. You don't necessarily need to do them raw. You don't need to juice them. But getting those extra vegetables in, because they will help to upgrade those phase 2 detoxification pathways. Two of my real favorite, three of my real favorite nutrients, though, specifically, one is called DIM. And this is actually an extract from broccoli, which is why we want to eat more broccoli when we're detoxifying. Mm-hmm. And it'll moderate phase 1 detoxification. And that's what we want to do with phase 1. We don't want it too fast. We don't want it too slow. It's kind of like a Goldilocks phase. We want to moderate it. And then DIM will also increase the clearance of through phase 2 detoxification. So will two other nutrients. One is called liposomal glutathione, and the other is NAC. And NAC is actually, or N-acetylcysteine is the precursor to glutathione, but they work in tandem together. Not only do they dramatically reduce the production of inflammation in the body, but they also are the two biggest increasers or stimulators of phase 2 detoxification. Then in terms of supporting the stress side of things, I think we mentioned this in our last show, that lactium peptide. And what that will do, lactium, which is that extract from milk, will bind straight to our stress glands, our adrenal glands, and decrease the excess production of stress hormones. But it will also bind into a gland in the brain called the hypothalamus. And ultimately, that is the gland that keeps telling our adrenals to keep making those stress hormones day in and day out. So we can moderate those pathways really well. Exercise, also a really fantastic thing, both for stress and detoxification, sweating out those toxins, getting that circulation going, getting your lymph going, and reducing cortisol at the same time. So today in Toronto, being 18 degrees, hopefully we're going to get there. Perfect day for that.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you so much for having me.
That was Penny Kendall Reed. We have to take a short break, but when we return, we'll discuss how psilocybin might be a working woman's life hack on The Tonic. The Big Carrot is a worker-owned natural food market that's been committed to local, organic, non-GMO, and sustainable food systems since 1983. They're a one-stop shop offering produce, grocery, bulk, body care, and holistic dispensary. The juice and smoothie bars and kitchens serve up hundreds of healthy dishes and drinks daily. Building community is at the core of their vision, which they deliver through education, outreach, and giving. They want everyone to share in the goodness they offer. Visit their website for more information at thebigcarrot.ca.
Welcome back to The Tonic, your prescription for a healthier and happier life. Here's your host and publisher of Tonic Magazine, Jamie Bussin.
Rob Grover and Gary Logan are the founders of the Journeyman Collective, the company creating luxury guided magic mushroom retreats at their center in British Columbia.
They've hosted CEOs, entrepreneurs, athletes, actors, couples, and small groups invested in the highest level of self-discovery and personal development through psychedelic plant-based medicine. Guiding guests through contemporary ceremonies using psilocybin, the pair have a combined 50-plus years of education in spiritual and metaphysical training, executive-level mindset coaching, energetic healing modalities, Alexander Technique lessons, and providing support embodying integrating transformational retreat. Visitors are immersed in an extraordinary personalized experience that often results in accelerated attendee success in their intentions to create a conscious impact on the world. Welcome back to the show, gentlemen. How are you?
Wonderful. So great to be here again.
So today we're going to talk about something specific. It's interesting. I was, you know, your group pitched me with the idea that psilocybin might be particularly beneficial for working women, which is interesting to me. Can you explain a little bit about that? Why that particular group might benefit from it specifically?
Well, for us, we have a high percentage of women that we work with. We're not sure why that happens, but one of the things that we note is that for some odd reason, women seem to be more willing to go on the inside of self and clear out the baggage of yesterday and get really clear of mind, clear of heart. And I think women are more quickly recognizing the need to do the deep inner work. And then that has an impact on their relationships, that has an impact on their career, their creative potential, their effective and optimized potential of where they're actually at in their career, whether it be working for a company or if they're a founder of their own company.
Is this willingness to take the journey or trip, as it were, and I don't mean that colloquially, is that what sort of drives back better results, or is there something else? Is there something physiological about women, or is it just their desire for self-improvement that drives more success?
I would say that, yeah, I think the process that we guide people in, it's a very deep process. It's a very deep experience where you have to basically allow yourself to be surrounded by a 360-degree mirror that allows you to look inside. And I think just where we're at in society, women are more willing and more willing to be vulnerable within themselves. And maybe it's the intuitive side that women have that's more turned on within women, and they're more willing to start paying attention to that. Although we do have an increase in men starting to come this year that are looking to sort of turn on their intuitive innate intelligence.
So let's talk about your belief system and these guided tours. So this is a little different. We had a guest on the show talk about microdosing, but this is more of a guided journey with full dosage, I would think, right?
Correct. We think micro journey is micro shift. Macro journey is macro shift. There is a purpose for each of those. We work with the macro, of course, and we feel that the work is very intensive and in depth, and that if you only go in with a micro or a small dose, you're not really going to tap in to your inner being, inner self. You're not being able to let go and release and move through whatever is shown to you at the journey time.
What are some of the things, I guess we'll speak empirically, what are your guests telling you about their takeaways when they're going through these journeys?
When guests leave, reluctantly leave, we say they are calm, peace of mind, content, more connected to self.
They want to have the deeper level conversations with people. They're no longer willing just to talk about the weather and sports. They really take the time to nurture their unique expression. And then they witness that has a big impact on their relationships with their spouse, their children, their families. And then that is only going to carry over into the workplace as well.
Okay, so we're speaking sort of on peripheral topics, like why do people do it? What can they hope to achieve? What is your feedback? But what is the actual process for somebody who doesn't understand it? What do you do? If I were to come out there, what am I going to experience? Yeah.
So very succinctly, we prepare people to come into this experience because most people don't have context for what a journey actually is or how it can actually impact our life. So we believe that everyone needs preparation. So there's 4 weeks of preparation, 4 full days in person. And then when you're with us, there's 2 guided journeys. So we guide you through those ceremonies from the inside. And then there's 2 full days of integration. where we are working with you on what you saw, the unique data set that was given to you. We're helping you to start to synthesize that data and information into your life. And then it's about you carrying that forward. Essentially, like that data set that you're given, you're going to carry that forward for the rest of your life, and you're going to use it to continue to evolve your awareness. And then once you leave, we're with you for another 3 months of integration support, so weekly Zoom calls. And then after that, you become a part of the collective, and you're sort of with us for your life.
Everybody's different, and I can tell you, I experimented a little bit with microdosing. I had a guest come on and suggest it would benefit me, and I found my personality type and the way I think, it actually kind of exacerbated some of my lesser qualities. In other words, my introspection, my tangential thought, it was actually, I found it more of a distraction. Is there a certain personality type that's more suited for this, for these more intense journeys?
I think you have to look at what the actual mushroom does. So if you look at the in nature, what does the mushroom do? It decomposes that which is no longer necessary, and it sends that nutrients out into the ecosystem. So when a human who is also nature ingests a mushroom, it's going to illuminate that which is not effective and not efficient. And then it's going to allow you to decompose what no longer serves you. So maybe there's a shift that's being called for you in that circumstance. And we believe that everyone should experience at least one journey in their life.
But this is not meant as a gotcha, but this is just like in my experience, there's just different types of people. And, you know, some tend to already be introspective and some less so. I would imagine for somebody who isn't terribly introspective, this would be a real mind opener, an eye opener. For somebody who's already there, though, are the benefits still there?
Oh, definitely. Yeah. And the thing is, it's like if you're not someone who wants to look within self, then the chances are that you're not going to find us. You're not going to actually want to come on a journey with us. So there's a deep level of teaching that takes place, so that you can really learn how to work with the medicine, work with introspection, work with contemplation in your own unique way. Some people like to sit in meditation for a really long time. Other people recognize that, hey, actually, when I run, I need to move. And when I'm running or swimming, I'm actually in a meditative state. So it can be very unique for different people.
It's beneficial for everyone. It doesn't matter where you are on the spectrum of life. If you think you're fully evolved, then maybe it's time you're going to check out soon. The idea is we're always evolving and always growing and expanding. So we do get clients that are at that stage of their life going, you know, I do the meditation, I am content where I am, but sometimes they just wave their hand in front of their chest. There's something missing and they just don't know how to reach it. And that's when the Journeyman Collective come into their radar and they explore what a journey would be like with us.
Okay. I understand that. What do you think people are taking away though? Like with these guided journeys, how is it actually helping people with their personal and more particularly their professional life?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So basically when someone comes into a journey with us, there's, as we already alluded to, there's a data set that's sort of given to each and every individual. What is that data set? There's different visions that people will see, and each individual is taught how to continue to pull on those threads of information. And it's something that we've just naturally created out of our own understanding of how to work with the medicine, is that you can continue to touch back into the visions that you were shown. And by continuing to do that again and again and again, you can synthesize that vision into your life, into your business, into your relationships. And so people have new business ideas that they've been possibly lamenting about for eons, and they just haven't had the bravery or the courage to actually step out and do it. And like, for instance, we had one individual who was like, I have to go create my own company, but I'm not sure if I can do it. After the journey, He left his current employer, and then he actually went out and created his own entrepreneurial marketing company. So a big piece of what people leave with is peace of mind, clarity, contentment, ease of making decisions. People become very decisive because they've started to tap into what we call the innate intelligence, which is connected into, on a physiological level, we have something called cardiac dendrites, which are in the heart field. And when people start to turn on that innate intelligence within the heart, they start to pick up on energy and information in a different way. And they're blending that with the thinking mind. So as a culture, we become a little bit dampened to only use the thinking mind. But we purport that when you start to use the heart mind and the thinking mind, that's when you can actually create a visionary reality for yourself.
Fantastic. Thank you so much for coming on the show today.
Thank you so much. This is great.
Thanks to all my wonderful guests, Andy Donnell, Dr. Charles Platkin, PhD, Dr. Penny Kendall Reed, ND, and Gary Logan and Rob Grover. And thank you all for listening to The Tonic. You can listen or download this episode as a podcast with full show notes, contact information for our guests, and links at thetonic.ca. To find out more about the show, you can always follow us at It's The Tonic on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter. For more timely, up-to-date, and accurate health and wellness information, subscribe to The Tonic newsletter. Now distributed once a week, The Tonic newsletter, with content curated personally by me, will keep you in the loop. There's contests, prizes, insider scoops, and so much more. Visit www.thetonic.ca and sign up today. If you're interested in providing feedback or suggesting topics for the show, you can always email me at jamie@thetonic.ca. On our next show, we'll discuss the health and wellness issues that are important to you. Until then, this is Jamie Bussin wishing you a healthy and happy week.
This podcast is proudly produced and presented by the Zoomer Podcast Network, home of great podcasts like Marilyn Lightstone Reads, Idea City on the Air, and The Garden Show.